KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a paleo nerd, don't you understand? I'm a paleo
nerd. Hey, Ray!
Why, hello, David. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing fantastic. This episode that's coming up today, it's one of my favorites. Well, it's my hero subject.
Well, I know. You got this thing, I guess. You keep bringing it up, and so I got you the guy.
You got me the guy. Well, again, it's the La Brea Tar Pits. My earliest memories is seeing those huge mammoth tusks.
Ah, so we're talking elephants today, right? So prehistoric elephants, living elephants, and all things elephant time.
Yes. And this is my hero episode.
Okay. Well, I hope you like the expert that I brought to you. He's very personable.
Cool. But before we get into that, there's some amazing paleo news.
Yeah. There's news out there, you know, news about one of my favorite sharks, maybe even being bigger than everybody thought, 80 feet long for Megalodon. But you told me about this other cool thing, and I did a quick study on it. Woolly mice.
Yes.
What's the deal with woolly mice?
Oh, my goodness. The implanted embryos in mice that have been, the genome has been genetically altered to give these mice the characteristics of woolly mammoth hair.
What?
Yeah, so it's hair, it's the color, it's fluffy, and not only did these mice get born, and you can see pictures of them on the internet. We'll have a link on this episode.
Woolly mice, and this
They're
is all
the
about...
the cutest things in the world. They even have a little extra fat under their skin because of the hair and cold climate and all that.
This is all about trying to bring back mammoths, right?
That's right. Apparently, they're close to the thylacine. I just read an article today about the Tasmanian tiger, which is not really a tiger, but the thylacine, they're close to bringing that back.
I'm down with that. I'm down with that. That sounds cool because that's recently, you know, extinct.
I want to see a pair of living mammoth tusks on a mammoth.
I don't know, man. It's we're going to talk about this today, but why to bring the mammoths back? Let's see what our elephant expert thinks about this. But, you know, one of the practical things that will come out of this, I mean, who doesn't want a woolly mouse, you know?
A woolly mouth?
Yeah, woolly mouse. Mouse.
You mean like lips?
No, woolly mouse.
Listen, you're lisping there.
No. They'll be the head of the pet industry, you know?
You know, years ago when I was drinking alcohol, I would wake up and have fur on my tongue.
Oh, man.
Should I ask our guest the difference between a mastodon and a mammoth?
Oh, yeah.
I'll ask him. Okay.
Ask him. We're going to go right into that, you know, and then those are the two basic prehistoric elephants people want, but we're going to get more species in there, some cool ones maybe you haven't heard about.
Cool. So tell me his name and how you met him.
Advait Jukar is his name, and I met him in Florida just a couple of weeks ago when I was down at the Florida Museum of Natural History with Kirk Johnson. We're doing research for this big fossil atlas thing we're doing. And we got to go out on a dig, and Advait was along, and he's...
And he's from India, right?
He is from India. Yes, he was born in India and moved to the U.S., when he was just a kid. So he's been here a long time, but he's a fun guy to talk to and very personable. And actually, he and I like the same sort of wine, so we bonded over that.
Very
and
good.
He also,
my girlfriend said he has gorgeous hair.
He does have gorgeous hair. I was very envious of his hair. Yes, we just relate to the woolly mice.
Yeah.
So anyways, Advait is a lot of fun, and I think you're going to like him, Dave. Shall we call him up on the old telephone?
On the mammoth tusk phone? Sure.
Call him. Hey, Dave, meet Advait Zucker. He is a paleontologist and also the assistant curator of vertebrate paleontology at the Florida Museum of Natural History in Gainesville, Florida. Hey, man, good to see you again. I just saw you a couple weeks ago. Welcome to the show, and meet Dave.
Hey, it's great to be here. Hey, Dave.
Very nice to meet you. This is my hero animal because I grew up as a kid. My first earliest memories are at the La Brea Tar Pits. Before they had the George C. Pei Museum, there was just this little circular rotunda with some fossils in there, and sitting on top was a giant mastodon or mammoth skull.
We'll get into that.
That was my introduction to fossils and paleontology, so I'm so excited.
That's fantastic.
And you must like elephants too.
I do, yeah. I have gone through so many phases, but I think my first love was elephants, and I've come back to it.
Oh,
so
good. Well, so you are.
Let me ask you. Though,
you want to ask?
Let me ask you. I want to ask.
Why don't you ask?
Hey, Advait, are you a paleo nerd?
I am most definitely a paleo nerd.
All right, my people. But yeah, back to your origin story. You were born in India. I was asking you as a kid, were you around elephants? And you said no. How'd your love of paleontology and elephants start?
There's elephants in India.
Yeah, there's tons of elephants in India. So I grew up in Bombay, which is a city of about 20 million people. Not a lot of nature, not a lot of wild elephants. I had a lot of books and a lot of documentaries growing up, and my folks encouraged that. And so when I was very young, my dad read the World Book Encyclopedia to me. And
wow.
I know, it's wild,
right? Is that every night
and
you went to bed?
With the World Book Encyclopedia.
Really?
And I think my favorite one was F, not E, interestingly, because I liked fish when I was extremely young.
Dude.
I know. We're sort of kindred spirits here.
We are.
One of the first words that I could say was the state fish of Hawaii, the Humuhumunu Kunukuapua.
Fun to say.
Let's say that again, one more time.
Hamo Hamo Nuku Nuku Apu A'a is how I say it.
There you go. I don't know how to say it. That's how I used to say it, but I
how do you, wait, how do you guys anyways. Know this? Okay, you as a child, but Ray, what is that about? Oh, you're a fish.
Well, I've been to Hawaii a few times, and I've been snorkeling. They're cool-looking fish, and I love to learn that name because it's fun to say.
Yeah. And then I just really liked elephants. And I went through this living elephant phase, and then I went through a dinosaur phase, a plant phase, a mineral phase, an Egyptology phase. And I came back full circle to big things, like fossil elephants when I was in graduate school. I wasn't always a paleontologist. I started off studying frogs in Korea.
Oh, really?
And
what?
Yeah.
Wait. You went to Korea to study frogs in Korea.
I was a college student in Portland, Oregon, and I got the opportunity to go to South Korea to stay on a mountain for 2 months and study a frog there called Bombina orientalis, which is the oriental fire-belly toad. It's the same kind of frog which you can buy in pet shops here, but they live in Korea. And they used to live on the mountains, and then rice agriculture came in about 6,000 years ago, and these frogs went down, took to the rice paddies, and they started to reproduce slightly differently. And what we were trying to do is understand how these populations are evolving. And that's how I really got in the weeds with evolution. And then I went to grad school to study fish.
Really?
I studied coral reef fish in the Caribbean. The ulterior motive was that I could go and lie on a nice white sandy beach in the Caribbean and study some coral reefs. No, I sat down in front of my computer screen at the Smithsonian crunching a bunch of data on Caribbean coral reefs.
Wow.
So,
yeah. Watch careful what you wish for, right?
I know, yeah. But all of that got me interested in long-term patterns in ecological change. And turns out that if you want to study climate change or if you want to study human impacts, it's really hard to do that in the modern because our data sets are just not long enough.
So recent, yeah.
40 years, at the most about 100 years.
Temperatures go back to what, 1890, something like that?
Something like that.
Well, I had the right century. Accurate temperature records begin around 1850. But check this out. Ice cores record temperatures going back up to 800,000 years in Antarctica and 123,000 years in Greenland. Now, tree rings give a reliable record, but matching all those stumps in a row generally go back to only about 2,000 years ago. Put that in your thermometer.
Well, before we jump in, dive deep into elephants, I just wonder, somewhere in there, you moved to the United States.
And I did.
What was that about?
When did that happen? United States, when did you go and study the Siwalik Hills in northern India? Was that after you went to the States and then came back to India?
That was during my PhD.
Oh, okay, because I read up on that. There's a significant number of Miocene and Pliocene fossils were collected in the 1830s.
Absolutely.
By an Oxford paleontologist, Hugh Falconer.
Yep.
And you went back and said, hey, this collection is valuable. Just real quick, why did that interest you and what did you find?
Because I'm from India and it was low-hanging fruit. So when Falconer discovered this stuff, it was hailed as the greatest fossil find of its day. He was awarded the Wollaston Medal along with Proby Cockney, the same medal that the Geological Society of London gave to folks like Darwin and Lyell. And it was so famous that it was touted as the greatest subtropical fauna ever found. Turns out no one else knows about this, but we have this incredible collection of rhinos and giraffes and elephants and fossil apes in the Indian subcontinent. And it was just a great place to study long-term ecosystem change in the subtropics.
Right.
The collections were accessible, and so I went to London and started to work on them. And then that took me on this long journey through museum collections and to the field in India. And that's actually how I got into elephants.
Oh, okay. The connection.
But somewhere in there, you moved to the United States as a kid.
I did. I was 17 years old, and I moved to Reed College in Portland, Oregon.
Ah, that's the Oregon connection.
That's
Reed.
The Oregon connection. I'm Reed.
We have many connections. All right, yeah. Cool.
Okay, so we know why elephants. Let's get to how come there are elephants.
And why are elephants so cool?
They come from Africa. So all elephants evolve in Africa. It's the same kind of origin story that we have. So about 60 million years ago in North Africa lived a tiny animal called Erytherium. It was about the size of a large rabbit or a small dog. It didn't have a trunk. It didn't have tusks. But there are some features of its teeth and of its skull that link it to elephants. It was only about the size of a small dog. And from there, we get this incredible lineage of some of the largest land mammals that have ever lived.
But with the most unique features and appendage.
They have the most absurd appendages ever because they take their front teeth, their incisors, and they supersize them. And that's what tusks are. Tusks are the second incisors in the upper jaw or the first incisors in the lower jaw, and they supersize them.
So wait, they're incisors in the upper jaw? They're not actually the canines?
They're not the canines. They're the incisors. Isn't that wild?
What happened to the canines? Are they just gone?
They're just gone.
The tiny animal that you're talking about way back in the Eocene?
In the Paleocene.
In the Paleocene, even.
Yeah.
So the Hyrax, the modern-day Hyrax, is about the same size, and what links it to elephants?
So it's got similar kinds of teeth, it's got similar kinds of facial bones, it's got similar kinds of toes, and based on the genetics, we know that Hyraxes are cousins of elephants.
Wow.
So what were the environmental pressures that caused this little dog-sized pachyderm, or not even a pachyderm yet, but...
Proboscidean.
Well, to
but
start
not
getting...
quite. Strangely enough, right? No trunk.
No trunk. So what were the pressures, the environmental pressures that started turning this thing into the elephant body plan that we know today? Even the ancient ones are very elephant-like. The Dinotheriums and the Amebelodons. How do you say that?
Amebelodon. Yeah. By the time you get to the Eocene and the Oligocene, the world starts to cool down and forests start to give way to more open environments. The food that these animals are eating starts to become more abrasive. They're starting to pick up more grit and dirt in their food. And so their teeth start to wear down. And in order to live longer, you have to be able to eat for a long time. And so one of the things that these animals evolve are larger and larger teeth. Now, they can't fit all of these teeth in their jaws at the same time, so they start to get larger jaws, and then they start to grow their skulls. And then you also had all of these big carnivores on the landscape, things like big creodonts, which would go and hunt them. And a sure shot way...
A creodont is a...
It's a carnivore. It's not in the order Carnivora.
It's a false cat?
No, it's not a false cat. It would have looked somewhat like a, I don't know, like a big hyena or a big.
It would look like a very toothy, big, hairy thing with lots of sharp teeth.
Well, I'll go ahead and have a link on your page to, so we know what a creodont looks like.
Creodonts and creodews. But yes, go ahead. So the creodonts are out there munching on these things. So there's kind of a pressure to get bigger for protection?
There is a pressure to get bigger for protection. And once you get big, then you can eat a lot of garbage food, which is out there. So a lot of plant matter is just not nutritious, but you have to eat a lot of it. And it behooves you to be big so that you can travel larger distances to actually get that food. And there are all these evolutionary changes taking place at the same time in North Africa. So we see the evolution of larger sizes, we see the evolution of larger teeth, their faces start to get long, their tusks start to evolve, and at the same time, you start seeing the evolution of the trunk. Because if you don't have a trunk, you can't drink water with those elongated faces.
Okay, wait a minute. Let me see if I can picture that one. Hold on. So you have a long face like a, let's just say a hadrosaur, dinosaur has a long face.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have trouble drinking water.
And then you
water.
Have tusks that stick out from the end.
Okay, so you have this thing preventing you from getting in the water there.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like a bumper.
The sauropods are these gigantic things, but they have a huge long neck. So they can get down to the water to drink.
Yep.
So there's this weird thing that starts happening with the nose area. You can see it ever expanding in the skulls.
And it starts to actually pull back towards the top of the skull. Because that's where we have the nostrils on a living elephant. They aren't actually at the tip of the snout. A modern elephant has a flat face with the nostrils right in between its eyes.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so wait, what's the little, is it the dick-dick? What's the little creature that has a little
It's proboscis? The dick-dick, yeah.
Yeah, are those Indonesian forests?
Dick-dicks are in Africa.
Africa, okay.
Yep.
So
what's the deal with the dick-dick?
Well, it has the same. Let's just call it a proto elephant because it has a smaller proboscis.
It's just a slightly elongated nose. Think of a taper. That's probably closer to what some of these earlier elephants may have looked like, but with a longer trunk.
And so the dentition grew first?
It's unclear what came first because all of these changes kind of show up at the same time. So in the Fayum in Egypt, where you also get things like the giant whale Basilosaurus, you get early elephants like Theomia and Paleomastodon, which all have these elongated faces with a set of upper tusks and a set of lower tusks and a nasal passage that is kind of pulled back on top of the skull, which shows the development of a long trunk.
Huh. And that weird-looking skull
is looks skeletal. That's only through skeletal. You're referring to the fleshy parts, though.
Yep. And it's all based on comparisons with living species.
Sorry, Ray. I didn't mean
things like tapirs have these retracted noses.
So that skull does look like a giant cyclops head in a way. Because that's one of the theories in ancient Greek times they had seen elephant skulls looks so much like a cyclops, that and huge nasal opening.
Absolutely. And it's probably dwarf elephants. So there were elephants in Europe which got isolated on the Mediterranean islands repeatedly from the early Pleistocene onwards, and they were mammoths and paleoloxodons, so huge hulking animals that weighed about 12 tons on the mainland. They get isolated on these islands. And there just aren't enough resources to support the big things, so they eventually will all evolve into these smaller forms. And the skulls of these dwarf elephants are, I don't know, about a foot long to about 3 feet long, so not that big.
Wow.
But this big nostril in the middle of the head, and the eyes are actually on the side. And so the idea is that the Greeks and the folks around the Mediterranean who found these skulls in the caves out there may have thought that it belonged to a cyclops.
I love the idea of the tiny mammoths, the oxymoronic phrase there.
Wait, is there a term for island dwarfism?
It's called island dwarfism.
Technically, you got it. But yeah, Dave, in your neighborhood, right off there in the
Channel Islands.
Yeah, the Channel Islands. You've got dwarf mammoths.
Yeah.
But yeah. So today there are only three species of elephants alive. There's two in Africa and one in India. The two African ones are the African bush elephant and the forest elephant, and then the Asian elephant. The Asian elephant is most closely related to our beloved mammoths.
Absolutely.
But there are 160 extinct species,
yeah.
Which is crazy.
Really?
Yes. There are many, many varieties
wow.
there.
I want to find out the difference between a mammoth and a mastodon, but these are really recent iterations. Because I want to talk about the shovel tuskers and all
right.
that.
We'll get there, but let's do this first, the mammoth and mastodon.
So mammoths belong to the family Elephantidae, and Elephantidae are characterized by these elephants with relatively tall teeth with parallel rows of cusps. We know that mammoth teeth are huge. It kind of looks like a basketball shoe.
Yeah. In fact, those are the teeth you see in the rock shops.
Absolutely.
Usually.
Yep.
And flat.
What's their age?
And flat. So the mammoth teeth in the rock shops are probably from the last ice age. So they're probably about 20,000 to about 12,000 years old. You do get older mammoths in North America. Mammoths show up here about 1.8 million years ago. In fact, the oldest mammoths in North America are from Florida, from the Lycee Shell Pit. So it's kind of cool being here.
Wow. That's where you're at?
I'm a bit further north from the Lycee
right.
Shell Pit, but I'm in Florida, home to the first mammoths on the continent.
Okay, so they became extinct at what, 12,000?
About 12,000, yeah.
Although there's some that lived till 4,000 years ago on
yep.
a little island.
The woolly mammoths, but the big
right.
Colombians, they go extinct at around 12,000 years.
Okay, so wait, there's a woolly mammoth and a Colombian mammoth? And we're not even
yeah.
talking mastodon yet, right?
No,
there's many
no,
flavors
so,
of mammoths, yes.
Okay,
yes,
let's hear
absolutely.
About the flavors of mammoth then.
So they first evolved in Africa. They show up sometime around 6 million years ago or so. Is this thing called Mammuthus africanavis and Mammuthus subplanifrons, and then they leave Africa and show up in Europe and turn into this thing called Mammuthus rumanus, found in Romania and China. And then we get this thing called the southern mammoth, which ranges all the way from China to Britain.
Wow.
A population of the southern mammoths in Siberia gives rise to what we call the steppe mammoth, Mammuthus trogontharii. They then disperse out west into Europe. One population of those goes across the Bering Land Bridge and down through Alaska and the Yukon into the Americas and gives rise to the source population for the Colombian mammoth.
Okay.
Then a population of these steppe mammoth in Siberia, and this is important because this is a funky story that was revealed only a couple of years ago.
Okay.
One of those populations, about 700,000 years ago, gives rise to woolly mammoths. And they then disperse out. One of those populations comes down into North America and interbreeds with the Colombian mammoths. So at that point,
oh.
the Colombian mammoths are mostly Colombian mammoths, to some extent woolies. Then a second immigration of woolies takes place in the late Pleistocene, and they will interbreed with those Colombian woolly hybrids again, to the point where late Pleistocene Colombian mammoths seem to be about 60% steppe mammoth, 40% woolly mammoth.
Okay.
And you know this
so,
through genetics because there is DNA. DNA
yeah,
has been recovered.
Absolutely, yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
So that's only the mammoth story.
That's the mammoth story. The mastodon story goes even further back.
But wait, how far south has a mammoth been found in North America?
You get them in
Mexico.
All the way south, yeah.
So mastodons were here earlier in North America than mammoths?
Yeah, so a mastodon means boop tooth or nipple tooth, depending
yes,
on
like,
who you talk
love
to.
Yes, I love that, because
yeah.
of the shape of the teeth, right?
Okay,
because of the shape
okay,
of the teeth.
Okay, little boys, why don't you explain it in a scientific way?
The
why
mammary
it's
tooth?
A boob or mammoth?
Boop tooth.
Mammatus tooth.
So Georges Cuvier, who's the father of comparative anatomy, called them mastodons. Right.
I was there in Paris.
You were there in Paris in the 1700s.
No, last year.
Museum. And so back in the 1700s, he described five teeth, and two of them belong to what we now call true mastodons, and three of them belong to gomphotheres, which is a different group. But they all have these sort of bulbous cusps on their teeth, and some of them on their cusps have these little bumps. A characteristic feature of these teeth is that of nipples or boobs, and so he called them mastodont.
Right.
And when you look at them, it's really, you kind of have to squint to really see tits on these teeth.
He was drinking.
You know? Tits.
I don't know. Yeah, I can see that, yeah.
And what was Thomas Jefferson preoccupied with?
Mammoths
or mastodons?
This is one of my favorite stories about America. The first mastodon tooth in America was found in 1705 by a Dutch tenant farmer in Claverack, New York. He had no idea what this was, so he gave it to a local politician for a pint of rum. After that, it was a great trade. After that, people had been finding these mastodon teeth all the way from New York down to Virginia and Kentucky, and mastodon mania kind of hit the colonies. They had no idea what they were, so they called them the great American incognitum.
Incognitum. Wow.
Incognitum. Yeah. In, I think it was 1801, Charles Wilson Peel found what was then the most complete skeleton of a mastodon in this pit on a farm in upstate New York. And it was displayed in Philadelphia at his museum. Jefferson saw this. Jefferson was intrigued by mastodons. Back in the day, the idea of extinction wasn't all that prevalent. And Jefferson didn't really buy it, even though Cuvier was talking about extinction at around the same time.
Well, wasn't he hoping that the core of discovery, that Lucy Clark would find
Absolutely.
The living mammoth?
Yep.
It was part of the directions,
that was 1800.
Yeah.
That was right in 1800.
1804, yeah.
The reason he did that is because there was a French naturalist at the museum in Paris named Buffon. And Buffon's a famous guy. He wrote, I think, something 20-plus volumes of his natural histories. And in one of them, he articulates his theory of American degeneracy. And according to
true, man. Yeah. Anyway, all right, go ahead.
Right. According to this theory, everything in America was stunted and lowly, and it grew on this unproductive soil. But the thing is, Buffon had never been to the Americas, so he had no idea what the wildlife of the Americas was like. He had just heard of things. Now, Jefferson took umbrage to this and said, "Bitch, please, we have mastodons in this country, and I'm going to prove it to you." So one of the things that he did was to send Lewis and Clark out west to actually find a living mastodon. He also sent emissaries to the Native American tribes trying to see if they actually had words for mastodon.
Wow.
And you can go see these vocabularies at the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia today.
Wow.
And it turns out that there aren't any tribes who have a word for mastodon. So
yeah.
Yeah. So
and there were several very famous fossil sites. There was one Big Bone Lick,
Big
which
Bone
is fun
Lick?
To say, in
I
Kentucky.
Know.
And all kinds of mastodons. Were there any mammoths in that?
There were mammoths at Big Bone Lake. Yep, absolutely.
So mastodons and mammoths did not exist simultaneously.
Oh, yes,
yeah.
They did. Yes,
well, they did.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So they're two separate species.
Two separate species of
proboscidian. Oh, and so what is the earliest mastodon and the latest mastodon? Because the La Brea tarpon claims to have both a mastodon and a mammoth skeleton.
There are several species. So true mastodons come from the family Mammutidae. And the Mammutidae, like most elephants, traces its origin back to Africa. And the first ones show up sometime in the Oligocene around, I want to say, 29 million years ago in Africa. And then they disperse out. They show up in North America sometime around 17 million years ago. And they diversify. Not much is known about them, but there are some really massive mastodons. There's a site in Tennessee called the Gray Site where they have this enormous specimen of a Pliocene mastodon with huge tusks. It's currently unnamed, but it's probably one of the bigger specimens. They have tons of mastodons in Nebraska, including a specimen that was once called Mastodon grangeri from sometime in the Pliocene or Pleistocene. It's unclear, but it had these like 14-foot-long tusks.
Whoa.
That would stick out straight out of its skull.
It's crazy.
It's crazy.
If you were to have a mastodon and a mammoth in front of you, what are the defining characteristics to tell them apart?
Mammoths are taller. So in general, mammoths have taller shoulders than mastodons. They have a more slender frame. Mastodons are chunky. They've got robust limbs. They have a big butt.
Yeah.
They have tusks which curl but don't twist. Mammoth tusks will curl and twist.
Yeah.
And that's one way of actually telling them apart. Mammoth skulls also tend to be taller than mastodon skulls and flatter. Mastodons have a longer face. And some kinds of mastodons have tusks in their chins. whereas mammoths don't.
Right. Mastodons are just more kind of, stout.
They're meaty, while the mammoths are larger and
lankier, you know.
Right. So what is the biggest mammoth ever? That would be the winner, right?
The biggest mammoth, that's a hard question to answer, because there are some really big specimens in North America. Colombian mammoths, the ones that I've seen, could have weighed upwards of 10 tons. So 10, 12, 13 tons. The big steppe mammoths or the big southern mammoths also weighed about that much. So these are huge
elephants. An African elephant would weigh what?
The biggest one killed and taxidermied, which is at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History, Henry, I've estimated its weight at about 8.5 tons.
So he's still smaller.
Still smaller.
A couple of weeks ago, when I was in the collections with you, I was asking about Amebelodon, the famous shovel tusker, and then you showed me something that totally blew my mind. Conobelodon? How do you say it? But this was a massive, massive shovel tusk elephant. Maybe one of the biggest ever, but you have actually postcranial stuff. Tell us.
We do.
How cool is
Tell
Kono.
Us what an ambibelodon and a double
And how cool is Conobelodon?
Explain what they are, why they are, and then tell us why this is so big and what you found.
All right, I'm going to take you guys back to Africa. So back to the Oligocene, when all of this diversification is taking place, you've got a group of elephants called gomphotheres. They also have these boob teeth. But unlike true mastodons, their cusps are not as sharp. They've got blunt cusps. And there's one line of them that evolved shovel tusks. So all of these elephants back in the Oligocene, they have four tusks. They've got their upper tusks and their lower tusks. Most gomphotheres have peg-shaped lower tusks. Amebelodontids, or the shovel tuskers, have flat lower tusks, which look like a shovel in some species. So that's why they're
called
shovel tusks.
You mean a plate, literally a 3-foot-wide plate that sticks out 4 feet? Or
Not 4 feet, but it would be about a foot or so across.
Yeah, they're flat, shovel-shaped, side-by-side, two of them in the lower jaw, kind of between the upper tusks.
Yep.
Do they have a center space?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they have David Letterman.
Some of them do, Some of them have a
and
bit of
And obviously
gap.
They're for rooting up vegetables or whatever.
Interestingly,
right?
Not.
Yeah, so, what are they used for? What are they doing with that?
So some of it is display. Every single time you see a mammal with absurd structures that come out of its head, it's oftentimes for display. It's sexual. It's mine or bigger than yours.
How cool am I? All right,
Exactly. I mean, because there are some mastodons in Greece with the largest tusks ever found on an elephant. They're about 15 feet long, and they stick straight out of their heads. What is the function of this except to show off? They can't really fight with these. It's really hard to scrape off bark and then go back with your trunk and actually do anything with it, because they stick straight out of your face. It is purely to show off.
You got
to
eat.
Yeah, exactly.
So how are they eating with that?
They're using their trunks to grab plants and then scoop them into their mouth.
Well, the trunks are prehensile.
So they'll just grasp stuff and take it down under the tusks to their mouths.
And what is the largest tusk ever found extant or extinct?
I think the biggest tusk ever found was from a big bull African elephant, and they're about 10 feet in length.
That was really close, Advait. The longest elephant tusk ever recorded belonged to an African elephant and measured 11 feet 5 inches, that's 3.5 meters long. Sadly, this tusk came from an elephant shot in the Congo in 1955, and you can see it in the Natural History Museum in London. Now, this pair of tusks from this elephant are the longest known, though not the heaviest. Now, there is no confirmed extinct species with tusks definitively longer than 3.5 meters, and some fragmentary fossils suggest slightly longer tusks, but nothing verified has exceeded this length. And when you see a piece of carved ivory, or even the word itself, ivory, that sadly means a dead elephant.
Now back to the shovel tuskers giant Conobelodon.
Yeah.
So as you say, I always picture them kind of using that as sort of a scoop. You're saying that basically they're using the trunk and just sort of loading stuff into this big shovel, and is that how it's working?
Into their mouths. So if you have some reeds or grass, they're grabbing those with their trunk and then they're just scything them off with their tusks.
Well, when I was in the collection with you, you showed me the grass groove.
The grass groove. I know.
So in the lower tusk. So it was a lower tusk of a gomphotheer, and there was definitely a very deep groove in it. And you said that's where the grass, and they favor one side or the other, and they're just like always clipping the grass like that.
Yep, it's called a grass notch. And I actually learned about this just a couple of years ago. My colleague at the Smithsonian, Kay Bernsmeyer, showed me this strange tooth from an amoebalodontid from Africa. And they were trying to figure out if this notch could have been made by a hominin, by a human, for ornamental purposes. And so then I took a deep dive, and turns out that modern day elephants also have these notches in their tusks, because they're using them to scythe off some grass or to scrape. And they prefer a scythe. Yeah, elephants tend to be scythed. And grass is abrasive. Some of this bark is abrasive. And if they keep going and grinding it off with one tusk, you're going to create a notch.
Are they using the tusk to, you know, let's say, if I'm going to grab something, sometimes you need two hands to pull out. Are they using the tusk as a tool to maybe hold the grass as their trunk pulls it across, or is it after they've pulled the grass and then they use this notch or plate to get rid of the roots or crap on the side
of the grass? It's probably to hold it down, or they can grab the grass with their trunk and then just push their tusk through.
I love the sound of the grass groove, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, going with grass, yeah. Do you have more to tell us about Cunabella? Actually, so when I was there with you, I was lucky enough to go out on a dig with you. We went out to the Montbrook fossil site, and the gomphotheres there is Rhynchotherium?
Absolutely. It's Rhynchotherium.
Rhynchotherium, and it's sort of a Rhynchotherium graveyard. What's up with that?
But describe
what's so
a gomphotheer
cool?
compared to a mammoth, and how long is their trunk or not in tusk?
Gomphotheres probably had long trunks, kind of like the trunks on a mastodon or a mammoth or a living elephant. They had longer faces. Some of them had incredibly long lower jaws and four tusks. Two tusks coming out of their face, two tusks coming out of their chin. Conobelodon is a kind of gomphother called an amoebalodontid. These Rhynchotheres are a kind of gomphother as well. So they all have these bulbous teeth. That's how we define them.
I'm looking at Ray's elephant family tree, which we'll have on the episode page. Which, Ray, it's just absolutely beautiful. I see the amoebalodon there.
So,
yeah, great reference. Great reference.
So this Rhynchotherium seems to be a North America-specific lineage. It's unclear where they come from, but they probably evolved from some sort of ancestral gomphother stock, which showed up here about 17 million years ago. And what's amazing about this lineage is that eventually they lose their lower tusks altogether.
Yeah.
Their upper tusks are also twisted and they kind of spiral, which I think we saw in the collection.
Yeah, it's really cool, those spiraling tusks. Yeah, just the groove.
They grow
in the spiral, so they grow, they twist around.
They're rather beautiful.
Yeah.
So what's the deal at the Montbrook site? Why are there so many Rhynchotheriums, gomphotheres piled up?
It's in Florida. It's about a 40-minute drive from Gainesville near the town of Williston. It's on private property, but we've hosted about 1,000-plus volunteers over the last 10 years at this dig, and it's produced upwards of 500,000 specimens, which is quite remarkable. It's mostly a turtle graveyard. We find a lot of turtles there. But we also find a lot of elephants. So we find this gomphother called Rhynchotherium, but we also find mastodons there. It's an older species of mastodon. What I think is going on here is that these animals are congregating there when it's drier. They're dying and their bones are getting washed into this river channel. All these animals aren't dying at the same time. They're probably dying over 1,000 years or tens of thousands of years. But in geological time, that's a blip.
Yeah.
And so what we're sampling there...
But it's drying up water holes, you reckon?
It's probably a river system which is changing course, and these animals are coming there and dying, and their bones are washing in. We typically find bones of big things which live on floodplains. So we find rhinos, we find gomphotheres, we find mastodons. We don't find a lot of open environment species like camels and horses, though we do have them. And most amazingly, we found our first sloth after collecting for 10 years, which is quite remarkable.
Well, it's pretty close to the shore, and every now and then you're finding megalodon teeth in there.
Right? We do find shark teeth there, yeah.
It's just crazy.
But that's because so all of Florida is all a of Florida giant, is a giant sand cave.
And the sea level is coming in and out. And
but I have a question.
Yeah.
So what is the cause of death? And you find families together, or are these one elephant and then 500 years later there's another one, and over thousands and thousands of years you have 500,000 specimens?
That's probably what it is. Now, there are some jumbles of bone, like the one Ray was excavating, which probably formed at roughly the same time. And by same time, I mean over about tens of years or so, because it's a bunch of elephant bones and some rhino bones and some turtle that's all kind of gotten washed in.
So these are not articulated then?
Some specimens are articulated, but for the most part, they are disarticulated.
That's river
some
wash.
It's all stuff that gets washed in.
At the elbow of a river, is that the kind of distribution?
It's a stream which is braiding, and so we're getting channels which form, channels which break off, and over time, these bones are collecting in there.
You know, there was one thing I learned from you, too, that elephants get six sets of teeth.
They do.
And they come in from the back of the, they don't come up out of the jaw, they come in. And you were talking about the spit tooth, which I never knew about. And can you tell us, tell Dave about
that? What do you mean six sets of teeth? They start with six teeth?
No, they don't. So we have all of our teeth in our jaws at the same time.
Right.
We have 32 teeth. Before we get our adult teeth, we have a set of baby teeth or deciduous teeth, and they fall out, and then we get a tooth which comes up from the bottom to the top or from the top to the bottom, depending on your jaw. Elephant teeth are too big to fit in their jaws at the same time. So modern elephants, all mastodons, and most gomphotheres have three baby premolars, just like your baby premolars, and they have three permanent molars. They will have about a tooth or two in their jaw at any given time. As these teeth wear down, they wear down from the front to the back and the top to the bottom. A tooth starts to develop at the back of the jaw and pushes its way in like a conveyor belt, and the tooth which is getting worn down will get worn down to a nub in the front that then gets spit out. That's called a spit tooth.
They actually spit it out.
They actually spit it out.
Really?
Yeah.
So how many teeth come out? So they have three sets in their lifetime?
They start off with what? A one-year-old baby.
A one-year-old baby will have the second baby premolar and part of the third baby premolar exposed.
So that's
at birth.
Two on each side?
Two
on each
side.
Bottom and top?
Yep.
So four teeth total.
Four teeth total, yeah.
Right.
And then the third tooth will come in, and the first tooth will get worn down.
Wow.
And then the molars will eventually come in. And what's great about this is that you can actually tell an elephant's age based on which teeth are in occlusion and how worn they are.
Do they eventually all wear away, and you've got like these sad elephants just with barely a tooth in their mouth?
Now they're called matriarchs.
I have seen some elephants with really worn down teeth, and that's when they die. So they either die before the last molar or their wisdom tooth wears down completely, or it wears down to the point where they just can't chew anymore. And then they can't eat enough. Yeah. But at that point, they're, you know, well into their 70s.
Yeah. So current elephants today have incredible social structures, mm-hmm. and they have generational teachings. Mm-hmm. I saw a documentary years ago of these elephants that went into a darkened cave to get a salt lick in the back, and it's so dark that they know it by the feel of the rocks. Mm-hmm. So that is obviously taught from matriarch to baby elephant. Is there any evidence of that type of social behavior in our extinct elephants?
Yes, there is. Oh. Absolutely. From trackways. So we have preserved trackways of multiple kinds of elephants which show herds. And sometimes it's somewhat large tracks and smaller tracks, which we've inferred to be matriarchal herds. Because then every so often you'll get a solitary track, which is even larger, and that's probably a bull,
right,
which is either following them or just going off on its own. And we see this in Abu Dhabi. We've seen this in North America. There are lots of examples of these elephant tracks, and they're going in herds.
These are fossil tracks.
Yep. Yeah.
There's a site, wow. It's in South Dakota. It's like a, Kirk and I called it the Mammoth Mosh Pit.
Yep.
And all of the elephants, all of the mammoths that were died there seem to be teenage males.
They're all teenage boys, and they're all kind of stupid, and they go down to the water's edge thinking it's a nice hot tub, and they slip in and fall down, and then they can't get back up. So they're in this sinkhole.
Really?
And they're starve or drown and die in there. It's called the Mammoth Site in South Dakota.
Yeah.
It's an incredible place.
Are there carnivores like the tar pits and stuff?
I'm not sure if there are carnivores there, but a lot of the bones don't seem to have a lot of damage. I think it's just a sinkhole which was full of water and warm vegetation in the cold ice age, and they went in there and slipped in and fell down.
And how can you tell if they're male or female? Size?
Based on their hips. So a female has a larger birth canal.
Did you ever hear of the story of someone finding mammoth meat? It was a cache of mammoth meat that was wrapped in an oil cloth or a piece of skin in a bog in North America. I read something about that years ago. Do you know anything about that? And someone tried to eat it?
Yep. Oh, gosh. People have tried to do this, and it's not a good idea because it's not really preserved. It's sort of pickled to the final degree.
But it was placed there by a human who lived alongside mammoths.
Yeah, so there's this idea that humans use bogs as refrigerators for mastodon meat. And they found
evidence
of this.
Or sink them in the lake. Right.
Or sink them in the lake, yeah. So in what happens when a pond freezes over in the winter is that the water under the ice actually stays at about 4 degrees Celsius. It's because of a phenomenon called the anomalous expansion of water beyond a certain temperature. And so it stays at the temperature of an icebox, which is great because you can take this entire carcass, which you cannot possibly eat in one go, and put it in your icebox for a later day. And they found skeletons of mastodons at the bottom of these bogs with these giant boulders. And there's a professor at the University of Michigan named Dan Fisher who tried to recreate this. He took a dead horse and he sunk it to the bottom of a pond with some rocks. And then they pulled it back up, and the meat was still good, and some of them ate it, I believe.
Right.
How long did the horse sit at the bottom of the
winter?
Over the winter, yeah.
But what I'm saying is, did anybody find an ancient cache of mammoth meat?
I've heard of this story as well, so quite possibly.
So I'll do some searching for this episode.
Yeah, I did a little research. In 1951, the Explorers Club claimed to dine on frozen mammoth meat, later thought to be Megatherium, a giant ground sloth. But DNA testing revealed it was actually green sea turtle, turning this legendary meal into a slow-cooked publicity stunt and a perfect reminder of why museums keep receipts.
Mammoth meat is coming out of the permafrost all the time.
Yeah, because when I tasted Bogman, he wasn't very good.
Well, I'm curious, have you been brought in to work on the kill site?
Funny you ask that, because I just published a couple of papers on what is possibly India's oldest butchery site. So,
really?
The Ice Age of India had a lot of really big extinct elephants, and one of them is called Palaeolophsodon. It's one of the biggest elephants to have ever lived. It evolved in Africa sometime about a million years ago and spreads out across Eurasia. And this Palaeolophsodon was found in Kashmir in the high Himalayas in what are probably the margins of an ancient lake. So the entire Kashmir Valley today was a lake, and at the margins of this lake was this incredible ecosystem that hosted giant elephants.
At what altitude, though? Because it would have not been as high a million years ago, right?
It wasn't as high. So this site is probably only about 300,000 years old.
Yeah.
But it was still high. It was still, you know, thousands of meters up in elevation. And so these elephants were there. And remarkably, this skeleton was found in association with 87 stone tools. And these stone tools were not made by our species. It was made by a different species of human. We still don't know who that was, But the stone tools look like the tools that Neanderthals have made elsewhere in Eurasia.
Well, I know this is kind of a dumb question, or maybe there are no dumb questions, but how do you kill a mammoth with basic stone tools? I mean, it's quite a challenge as we little primates try to take down this massive beast.
Well, there's two ways. Cliffs or spear points? Come on.
Yeah, it could be spear points. It could be cliffs. Or it could just be, you know, rocks. Just keep tossing rocks at it, scare it, try and injure it as much as it can, hope that it bleeds out. It is very hard to kill big elephants, but it's very easy to scare them off a cliff, and then you go and butcher them.
Well, even if you have a spear, where are you going at the mammoth? Where do you go at the mammoth?
Where it can't run you over. That's where you get at it.
So they've actually found spear points lodged in mastodon ribs, so they are trying to get at their flanks.
Huh, interesting. So there are actually spear points that have been found, like, embedded into the actual bone itself.
So in Washington State, there's a site called Manis, and the Manis Mastodon.
Oh, I've been there. I've talked to his widow.
What is his widow?
It's a point which is lodged in this mastodon rib, and so it was clearly hunted.
But that was actually took about 30 years before they actually got around to CT scanning it. Yep. Nobody believed it at first.
What kind of point? It's not like a Clovis point, just a regular...
It's a bone point. It's actually made of bone. Yeah.
Wow. So,
anyways, interesting stuff. Do you have any opinions on the Cerruti kill site, alleged kill site, which is maybe 100,000 years... 100,000-year-old site in San Diego.
Yeah, in San Diego. So... I think it's an extraordinary claim which requires extraordinary evidence that hasn't been presented yet.
Okay.
Basically, they found it's real old mammoth death assemblage with potential...
It's mastodon.
It's mastodon.
We'll explain what it is and why there's a controversy.
So it's a mastodon skeleton that was found in association with what might be stone tools and some evidence of damage on the bones. It's a controversy because it is really old. The first evidence of any kind of human in North America is about 22 to 25,000 years ago.
That's the White Sands.
It's the White Sands. That's the oldest confirmed, although there are extremely old sites that could go back as far as 33,000 years in Mexico and in parts of the eastern United States.
I believe it.
There are old sites up in Bluefish Cave.
Is that in Oregon?
I think Bluefish Cave is in Oregon, yeah. So there are places on the continent with old sites. But this is really old. This is about 100,000 years old.
Right. 100,000.
Which is when humans left Africa, or at least our species left Africa. So it could be something else.
If you walk really fast for a couple of years, you could get there.
But the other problem is that there's a construction site not too far away, and someone had argued that the heavy equipment may have actually broken some of those rocks and damaged those bones.
Right,
that's a giant confound there.
Right.
There were elephants everywhere in North America, all around the world. They were everywhere. People are always amazed to find out, mammoths, mastodons, every county in Nebraska's got them. We got them here. You got them in Florida. It was an elephant paradise.
Yeah.
They're in Mexico, everywhere. They also make it all the way down to South America. And then there were none.
They made it to South America?
Those rhynchotheres in North America, the ones that you find at Montbrook with the twisty tusks, they lost their chin tusks. And they go down to South America as this gonfalon called Couveronius. And then there's a second one called Notiomastodon. So there are two kinds, at least, in South America.
So they make it pretty much everywhere around the world.
Except Australia.
They don't make Australia and Antarctica. But they're everywhere, and then they go extinct. Are we the killing species? Or was it
climate change?
Or was it both? But what is your opinion, sir?
So my opinion on this is that you cannot explain the extinctions without humans. Climate change has come. It's the glacial cycles have come and gone about 25 times in the last 2.5 million years. And many of these species made it just fine through all of those cycles. The extinctions everywhere around the planet typically start when our species shows up. The pattern of the extinction where only large things preferentially go extinct, they don't go extinct at the same time, and they only go extinct after humans show up, says that we probably had something big to do with this extinction. It doesn't absolve climate change altogether. So here's what climate change does. It fragments populations. If you have a population of woolly mammoths, which are cold adapted, and it starts to warm up, they're going to move further and further north. And we've seen this with simulations and with the actual bones, is that some of the last woolly mammoth populations in the last deglaciation in Europe were in Siberia, in these isolated pockets. The mammoths on Wrangel Island or St. Paul's Island were isolated there. And when you get small isolated populations about 3,000 years ago, and they were smaller. And the thing is, when you get small populations, which can't breed as well, elephants breed once every 6 years. They have a two-year-long pregnancy, at least. Some of the bigger ones may have had an even longer pregnancy. It's just hard for them to bounce back from stress. And then all you have to do is just add one extra stressor, just kill off enough babies, and you take a population which is already stressed down to extinction. I don't think we would have seen the same magnitude of the extinction had we not shown up on the continents.
And babies would have been easier to hunt.
Yeah, just the babies. Before I ask the one question, what's your opinion about de-extinction, the efforts to end? We were talking about the woolly mice before you came on. It's the latest thing in this effort to bring back woolly mammoths. How do you feel about that?
I say do it.
Do we have another hour? Jeez.
Yeah.
I had to bat this. Okay.
Do a mini rant.
Give us your pros and cons from your expert vantage point.
My mini rant is that we're not going to get a mammoth back, one, because even the company Colossal has now admitted that they're going to get a hairy elephant. We don't have a complete genome. We don't know what makes a mammoth. And as you were saying, these are social animals which learn from their mothers, which learn from the herd. You're going to get a hairy elephant who's raised by a female Asian elephant and is going to be taught how to be an Asian elephant. Then you're going to put this thing in the Arctic. That's just not going to work. And the reasons to bring this back isn't let's try to figure out what genes are responsible for the trait of being hairy or what genes are responsible for these massive tusks. It's let's put some of these mammoths back on the permafrost to shovel off the snow to make sure it doesn't warm up as fast. I think the rate of climate change is going a lot faster than the rate at which we're going to be making it.
It wasn't a charge admission?
I mean, eventually it's going to be a charge admission, but I think it's a harebrained idea. I think there's a lot of tech bro hubris involved.
The bro oligarchy ruins it again.
Exactly. So
it's not a very popular topic in Alaska.
No.
I actually didn't know that point of view, and I am now against it.
Yeah. There you go.
Let the dead lie.
Okay, so I want to ask you a very important question, Advait. Thank you for joining us here in the show, but Advait, if you could time travel back into deep, deep time, what exciting epoch, what delightful era, what precise paleo period would you want to go back to, and what would you want to behold?
That's a great question, Ray. I would like to go back to the late Miocene of either Asia or Africa, or possibly even Nebraska or Florida, because this is a point in time where you had multiple species of elephants that coexisted. Today on the landscape, you might see one species. In the late Miocene of Africa, you could have four, maybe five species in the same place. In the Sivaliks of South Asia, you had three or four species of elephants, maybe six species of rhino, lots of funky giraffes with strange antlers growing out of their heads, horses, cattle. It was a spectacular time and place when life in the Cenozoic was truly large. And I would love to go back there and see it.
Wow, beautiful, man.
So, question, speciation is due to environmental pressures, usually. So, animals will adapt and change their forms due to environmental pressures. Why would there be five different species in the same environment?
They're eating different things. There's just so much primary productivity around that they can do it. And the thing is, that is what the norm is. We live in unusual and abnormal times. Just in the last ice age, there were possibly seven kinds of elephants in North America alone. You had maybe three kinds of mammoths, if you count the pygmy mammoth on Santa Rosa Island, four. Two kinds of mastodons and Couveronius, the gomphothair. And in places like Florida, you had Couveronius, the mammoths, and the mastodons all coexisting in the same place. Having large things on the landscape is common. It is common from the age of dinosaurs, from the Permian, when you had all those crazy mammal ancestors, all the way through the Cenozoic up until now.